Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents 43, Inside the George W. Bush Presidency, edited by Michael Nelson, Barbara A. Perry, and Russell L. Riley, narrated by Tom Parks. Publisher's Note. In this audio edition, you will hear references to tables present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Preface. In June 2008, two emissaries of President George W. Bush, Ambassador Mark Langdale, who would soon head Bush's Presidential Library Foundation, and Bush's longtime political advisor Karl Rove, made a quiet visit to Charlottesville to meet with the senior leadership of the Miller Center at the University of Virginia. Langdale and Rove had been dispatched by Bush during the final year of his administration to begin planning for his post-presidency, especially the construction of his presidential library and its activities. The purpose of this meeting at the Miller Center was to discuss a presidential oral history. Although the Miller Center had conducted significant oral history projects on every president since Gerald Ford, a partnership with Bush was far from a given. Among other things, some members of his network harbored a confirmed skepticism about academics and their intentions. But as the conversation unfolded, including extended discussions about the nonpartisan purposes and professional methods of the Miller Center's oral history work, the conditions for a productive partnership emerged. That arrangement, later blessed by President Bush himself, would include major funding by the Bush Foundation to cover the cost of the interviews, then standard procedure for the Miller Center, paired with a commitment to allow the center's scholars complete academic independence in conducting and recording the oral histories. The shared purpose of this enterprise was simple: to create a lasting record of recollections by those who had served in the senior-most positions from Bush's 2000 campaign to his transition out of the presidency in January 2009, both the good and the bad. No questions were off-limits. The chapters in 43, Inside the Presidency of George W. Bush, constitute the first thorough scholarly use of these oral histories. Some 90 interviews were recorded for the Bush Project, and almost 60 of them were available to the contributors. Each session normally lasted 7 to 10 hours, with interviews conducted by teams of scholars. Typically, they explore the interviewees' memories of their service with and for President Bush, along with their careers prior to joining the administration. Interviewees also offered political and leadership lessons gleaned from being eyewitnesses to, and often shapers of, history. Following standard oral history protocols, each interview was conducted in confidence, and the subjects were allowed to stipulate conditions for the release of their own transcripts. That assurance helped foster candor at the interview table. In drafting the chapters for 43, the contributing scholars mined these interviews for what they reveal about the inner workings and intentions of those serving in the Bush administration. But their research includes other public sources as well. Oral history provides invaluable inside evidence of White House behavior that can be captured in no other way. But it also suffers from the deficiencies of this intimacy. The chapters in this volume demonstrate how to make balanced use of these resources to enrich our understanding of recent presidential history. In his introductory chapter, Russell L. Riley describes the three stages of the Bush presidency: pre-9/11, war, and post-war. Michael Nelson then chronicles Bush's elections, not only his own election and re-election in 2000 and 2004, but also the other elections that occurred during his administration: 2002, 2006, and 2008. Jesse H. Rhodes assesses Bush's domestic policy of compassionate conservatism, with particular emphasis on education reform and his No Child Left Behind program, in Chapter 2. Various aspects of Bush's interactions with the rest of the government are covered in Chapters 4 through 7. Andrew Rudilevich analyzes the unitary executive aspects of the Bush presidency. John J. Pitney, Jr. examines the president's relations with Congress. Barbara A. Perry offers an account of his Supreme Court nominations. And Joel K. Goldstein discusses the distinctive aspects of Dick Cheney's vice presidency. The wars of the Bush presidency are treated separately by Michael Nelson, 9/11, in Chapter 3, and Spencer D. Bakich, Iraq, in Chapter 8. Robert F. Bruner, Chapter 9, examines the last challenge of the Bush presidency, the financial crisis that marked his final months in office. In the concluding chapter, Sidney M. Milkus weighs Bush's presidency against the balance of presidential history. Introduction. History and the Three Presidencies of George W. Bush, Russell L. Riley. No presidency in the lifetime of the Republic will be more difficult for history to get right than the 43rd, that of George W. Bush. In part, this is a function of the extraordinarily controversial nature of Bush's tenure. The first person to win the office while losing the popular vote since Benjamin Harrison in 1888, Bush was encumbered from the beginning with questions about his political legitimacy. He was sworn in with chants of the so-called Brooks Brothers riot still reverberating through the land, his victory based on a Supreme Court decision so inventive that the justices felt compelled to proclaim that it shouldn't be taken as precedent for other cases. Then, his watch was marked by an astonishing array of contentious developments, including the failure to detect and prevent the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, Hurricane Katrina, Abu Ghraib, and a massive expansion of the surveillance state at home and abroad. Few presidents have been more polarizing than Bush. A decade after his departure from the White House, Bush was still politically radioactive. In October 2019, photographers captured images of the former president seated next to popular television personality Ellen DeGeneres at a Dallas Cowboys football game, which she made the mistake of visibly enjoying. The event caused a media firestorm, with criticism raining down on DeGeneres for not treating Bush as a pariah. She fell precipitously from public favor. His unpopularity was contagious. George W. Bush is not the first president to provoke strong, enduring, visceral reactions. But these predispositions are formidable obstacles to the kind of clear-eyed and dispassionate analysis required of those who endeavor to commit a president to history. A second set of impediments confronting those attempting to create an authentic, historical Bush arises from the archival resources necessary to discover what actually happened behind the closed doors of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Here, paradoxically, are problems of feast as well as famine. The National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, reports, "The George W. Bush Presidential Library and Museum holds more than 70 million pages of paper records, 43,000 artifacts, 200 million emails, and 4 million digital photographs. That is a collection of almost unfathomable proportions." Historian Robert Caro, whose works on Lyndon Johnson set the standard for meticulous presidential research, has written that the core of his method, learned as a young investigative reporter, is to turn every page. What would doing so with the Bush documents entail? Let's assume, for purposes of illustration, that one could turn 1,000 pages a day. At that pace, reviewing the paper records alone would require 70,000 days of nonstop labor, 191 years. The collected email traffic is almost 3 times as voluminous. The search for needles in this colossal haystack will not be easy. Yet the more immediate problem facing students of the 43rd presidency is actually one of scarcity. Because of the terms of the Presidential Records Act, which governs the disposition of official White House documents, all but a tiny fraction of these millions of pages is unavailable to outside eyes, pending their review, clearance, and release by a small cadre of overburdened archivists. Each line of those 270 million paper pages and emails must be examined to make sure they do not contain national security information or private personal data that should, by law, remain out of the public domain. It will be a very long time before a significant percentage of this archival documentation is available to researchers. In the interim, which will be measured in decades, those trying to paint an accurate historical portrait of the Bush presidency must do so on the basis of a fragmentary documentary record guaranteed to be least complete on the most delicate national security issues. The problem of delayed release of records is not limited to Bush, of course. Each administration since Ronald Reagan's has been governed by these constraints. But the problem has been exacerbated for each successive presidency because of the exponential increase in the use of electronic communications, most prominently emails, which barely existed in Reagan's time. Accordingly, those who require written records to reconstruct the inner workings of each White House are compelled to reach conclusions fully aware that there are millions of pages of relevant evidence they have not examined because they cannot. Added to these familiar obstacles, however, is something unique to the Bush years, and, ironically, derived from his greatest accomplishment. The Bush administration's ability to prevent a follow-on attack after the catastrophe of September 11, 2001, an achievement continued by his successors, exerts a subtle but powerful adverse effect on our assessment of what Bush did in the Oval Office. To be sure, historical review is always distorted by the prism of retrospection. It is never easy to practice willful forgetting when looking back at the past. To understand the problems and prospects of those who faced events in our history as their future. Because we know how things turned out, there is a common bias in historical assessments that affects every presidency. In fact, every historical episode we examine. As the German essayist Walter Benjamin once observed, a man who died at 35 will appear to remembrance at every point in his life as a man who dies at the age of 35. This kind of knowledge distorts the history we write in ways that typically go unremarked, because of both the manifest advantages of being able to examine the full consequences of past actions and the relatively benign, or at least latent, costs of that omniscience. In Bush's case, however, this problem is singularly acute. At every point in his presidency after 9/11, the Bush of our remembrance is a man possessed by an event, a second terrorist attack, that never happened. Reliable sources, including National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and Homeland Security Advisor Francis Townsend, inform us that, for President Bush and his inner circle, every day that followed the initial attack was September 12th. The horror of those hours was the president's lasting preoccupation. He remained committed to doing anything he could, including stretching the capacious bounds of executive authority and military might, to prevent another life-threatening catastrophe. That reality defined his mission. Everything had this incredible sense of urgency, Townsend reflected in her oral history, and we all bore the weight of responsibility for the lives lost on 9/11. From the president on down, we felt a personal responsibility to make sure that never happened again. In his interview, Robert Gates, who became Secretary of Defense during Bush's second term, reflected on what this meant for those serving on 9/11. I was thinking to myself, what would I be feeling if I were in their shoes today, September 12, 2001? It is just this huge burden of failure that thousands of people lost their lives because I didn't do my job right and a bunch of other people didn't do their jobs right. What's wrong with us? How do we fix this? And how do we fix it overnight? That was President Bush's reality. The full intensity of that preoccupation is not easy to recapture and convey to people today, who know the second wave of attacks never occurred. Moreover, the absence of a second wave also subtly alters our ability to comprehend the nation's psychological state during those times. To be sure, the shock of September 11th is relatively easy to conjure again. Anyone old enough to have memories of that day can recall watching the Twin Towers collapse. Typically bundled with these memories are fragmented images of chaos and unity. Masses of New Yorkers heading home on foot. Chilling accounts of the doomed passengers aboard Flight 93. The grave countenances of the former presidents who supported the incumbent as he mourned the dead from the pulpit at the National Cathedral. Bush's spirited pledge of retaliation, delivered through a bullhorn in the midst of the rubble in Lower Manhattan. It is not the shock of those days that is hard to recapture. It is the primal sense of suspense that followed, the deep anxiety over what would happen next. Filmmaker Alfred Hitchcock made the distinction between shock and suspense central to his craft, and his methods are instructive. More than once, Hitchcock used the following film tableau to illustrate the point. Two men are seated at a table, carrying on an idle conversation. Without warning, a bomb goes off beneath them, killing both. The effect on the audience, Hitchcock notes, is shock. The sudden event stuns the viewer. But that effect is relatively short-lived. The film moves on to the next scene. Then, Hitchcock suggests an alternative. At the moment the two men meet, show the audience that there is a bomb under the table that will detonate in 5 minutes. That knowledge manufactures suspense. There is a looming menace as the clock ticks. Unease mounts as each minute passes. But, according to Hitchcock, as a matter of art, the film works best if the bomb never goes off. If the danger lasts for the duration of the movie, the viewer gets no relief. Tragedy could happen at any moment. That sustained anxiety was at the heart of Hitchcock's method. Yet, for the film to work as intended, the audience could not know the ending in advance. That knowledge would ruin the effect, disarming the suspense. Hitchcock's commentary helps us understand something significant about the presidency of George W. Bush and how we recall it. Until September 11th, most Americans had no idea that there might be a bomb under the table. Indeed, the shock of that day was so great precisely because, until that moment, so few Americans had thought such an event was possible. But for a considerable length of time thereafter, Americans were fearful of more bombs under other tables. As Peter Baker later reported in the New York Times, in the wake of the September 11th attacks, further violent death on a mass scale seemed inevitable. The clock was ticking. Today, however, we know how the story ended. The distortions of that retrospective knowledge are exacerbated by a second failure, the failure to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. One of the strongest memories Americans have about the Bush era is that the threat from Iraq was overstated. So it is natural for those recollections to intrude on memories of the global war on terror. That being so, the absence of a follow-up attack on the United States can easily appear to be one more indicator that the whole threat was overblown. Any such predisposition makes it exceedingly difficult to gain an accurate picture of the tenor of the times or the central motivating force of the Bush White House. This volume represents one effort to compensate for such obstacles. In these chapters, a group of accomplished scholars addresses some of the most controversial aspects of the Bush years, clarifying what happened and putting those developments in historical perspective. We also address the problems created by the constraints of the Presidential Records Act by drawing on an alternative source of evidence about the Bush years, presidential oral histories. For roughly 10 years after George W. Bush left office, scholars associated with the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs conducted scores of confidential interviews with senior officials from the Bush era, recording their memories. The chapters in this volume constitute a collective effort to mine that large cache of original historical materials. These interviews are not offered as the last word on any of the topics addressed, but they are among the most authoritative accounts available about a host of important political developments during the Bush administration. Finally, the insider accounts used throughout this book, best exemplified by Michael Nelson's curated interview passages recalling the terror of 9/11 in Chapter 3, Day of Fire, provide rich details about the inner workings of the Bush White House, including the tense character of the times. The oral histories thus convey nuances about hard decisions, choices that in retrospect may be too easily dismissed because the hunches of the decision-makers turned out to be wrong or the policies based on them turned out badly. Our scholarly mission is to understand as best we can what happened and why, which usually requires an empathetic approach, the ability to see problems through the eyes of those who were there. If we dismiss from the outset the real plight of those who govern, including the suspense of their times, there is no way to learn from their experiences. These interviews are indispensable if we hope to gain an understanding of the roots of both success and failure, including decisions that today might seem inexplicable. To be clear, acknowledgement of this extraordinary pressure does not amount to a blanket shield against criticism of Bush's presidency. There were dissenting voices, even among senior members of the administration, who urged more thorough diplomacy before invading Iraq or more realistic planning for the post-war period there. But a proper historical reckoning requires an understanding of why Bush acted as he did, even when confronted with prominent voices urging caution and restraint. It is impossible to understand history if we discount the weight on one side of the scale. Presidential scholar Richard E. Neustadt has observed that only the hardest problems get to the Oval Office. Presidential decisions are usually based on a 51-49 calculation of the benefits and costs, with just as many people arrayed on one side of the issue as the other. Seldom is a presidential decision a slam dunk, even when some advisors may argue otherwise. Accordingly, one of the most important responsibilities of the presidential historian is to retrieve and account for this complexity and how the participants wrestled with it, in effect, to acknowledge the fog of war. In looking back, often our duty is not to simplify the decisions we assess, but to borrow from Cambridge classicist Mary Beard, to make things seem more complicated. Every president governs within a deep institutional and cultural environment that limits what the incumbent can do and, at the same time, creates the basis for exercising presidential leadership. Normally, this environment does not change much over time, although it is more protean than the language of the Constitution itself. For example, there was not much difference in the Constitution when Franklin Pierce and Abraham Lincoln held the presidency, but the circumstances of their times, what might generically be called their regimes, were dramatically different. Lincoln was afforded far greater opportunities to exert vigorous and independent leadership. War required it. What we find in George W. Bush's presidency is an anomaly. During Bush's 8 years in the White House, he experienced three distinct leadership regimes. Framing these helps us better understand the historical forces at work in his time. A balanced system, January 20th to September 10th, 2001. George W. Bush, reflecting on his own wisecracking ways, occasionally quipped that he had his father's eyes and his mother's acerbic mouth. But he inherited something much more important from his father once he became president, an institution transformed by the successful conclusion of the Cold War. During the Cold War, the presidency was an empowered institution in a state of continuous readiness for nuclear conflict. Although it would be too much to say that the Cold War presidency was raised to the wartime heights of Lincoln, or Woodrow Wilson, or Franklin Roosevelt, those presidents who served after World War II never returned to anything close to a status of power equality with the other branches of the federal government. How could it have? Asked Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Democrat, New York, in 1991. In the course of 30 to 40 years, in which presidents knew they would have 10 minutes at most to decide whether to launch a thermonuclear second strike. That persistently elevated threat, punctuated by hot wars in Korea and Vietnam, and the unnerving jolts of Sputnik and the Cuban Missile Crisis, created two generations of presidents who dominated the American political system and the global landscape. But the victory in the Cold War that President George H.W. Bush helped secure brought an end to that quasi-wartime presidency, ushering in a decade of constitutional readjustment. Such periods are commonly characterized by painful institutional contraction. That was certainly true for the elder Bush and his successor Bill Clinton. Bush's re-election failure in 1992, Clinton's loss of a permanent Democratic majority in the House of Representatives and the Senate in 1994, and Clinton's 1998 impeachment, can all be traced to the conventional post-war impulses to right-size the presidential institution and restore something approaching a constitutional balance. By the time George W. Bush entered the White House, those post-Cold War contractions had left the presidency in an institutionally diminished state. The office he was expected to fill was neither a place of grand public designs nor a seat of soaring global leadership. That kind of office would have called for a president with expansive ambitions. Instead, Bush had more modest aims. He would replicate what he had done as governor of Texas. In 2001, Texas's governor was ranked 39th out of 50 in terms of statutory powers. Thus, what Bush had been able to accomplish in Texas was largely the product of cooperation with the state legislature. He had developed an especially fruitful and colorful relationship with Democratic Lieutenant Governor Robert Bullock, which allowed Bush to tell national voters that his style was consensual. Observers often commented on the bipartisan character of their partnership and what it meant for Bush. The relationship with Bullock...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?